is the New York State AFERD podcast entitled A through Z Health and PE. We are your co-hosts, Drs. C and C, the true Pan-American connection. I am Clancy Seymour, and my tag team partner is the one and only Dr. Victor Ramsey.
Details highlighting our episodes, guests, contact information, publications, and other useful resources will always be included in the podcast show notes. For more information about New York State AFERD, please visit newyorkstateaferd.org or Facebook and social media handles at New York State AFERD. Let's embrace the journey, and now, on to our show.
Greetings, listeners. I'm Dr. Clancy Seymour with my co-host, Dr. Victor Ramsey. Doc, how you doing today?
I am doing well. Thank you. Thank you. The weather has been wonderful down here today. It was almost like summer. And I always talk about the weather because it just so happened that one of our guests today is maybe because he's on, they're bringing some nice weather to us in New York. But it's been great, man. I had a wonderful day, very productive. And I'm looking forward to our show today.
Very, very well said.
How are you, by the way? How are you?
I'm doing great, thank you. You're right. It's up here in Western New York. You know, it's Buffalo. We're close to that Canadian border, as you know. And we've had some cold weather as of late. But today we had an unseasonably mild November day, which was great. And, of course, we have an extra hour to our weekend as well, which was nice, right? Yes. So we're coming off the daylight savings weekend and on to a new week, which is always enjoyable.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So, by the way, it was enjoyable watching the marathon yesterday as well. What an amazing feat by these runners. I mean,
they're incredible indeed.
Beautiful. I agree. Yes, I agree. Beautiful to have the marathon back. So,
welcome to the New York State AFERD A through Z Health and PE podcast. In this episode, both the prestigious Drs. Steve Silverman and Risto Martinen, yay, are joining us to discuss an important topic in the disciplines of health, physical education, and sport. Okay, this is exciting, Dr. Ramsey.
Yes.
We are truly honored and excited to introduce our special guest for today's episode. First is the one and only Dr. Steve Silverman. Dr. Silverman is Dean and Professor in the College of Education at Florida Atlantic University and Professor of Education Emeritus at Teachers College, Columbia University. For over 40 years, he's conducted research on teaching and physical education with an emphasis on motor skill learning and attitude development. In addition, he has published papers and books on research methods in kinesiology and the social sciences. Dr. Silverman, thank you for joining us today, and please say hi to our listeners and, of course, the illustrious members of New York State AFERD and the professional community. Although you're in Florida currently, I know the city and state of New York, along with New York State AFERD, are near and dear to your heart.
I attended quite a few New York State AFERD meetings. I do want to pick out one of the things you said. Risto is also illustrious.
Of course, indeed.
I'm happy to be on here with him.
Well said. Well said.
Thanks, Steve. Really appreciate that.
Well, without further ado, our second guest is Dr. Risto Martinen. Dr. Martinen is an associate professor in the School of Education at George Mason University. His research focuses on physically active after-school programs and the integration of other subjects into physical education settings. Risto, welcome to the show, and you're typically on the other side of the table in these forums.
Correct. This is probably only my second podcast that I've been a guest on. So thank you very much for the invite. And as with Steve, not as long, but I have been a New York State AFERD member in the past because I went to school the same place Dr. Victor Ramsey went. So Teachers College, and I paid my dues for a couple of years there, president.
Oh, that's great, Risto. That's fantastic. We appreciate your membership and support indeed. And of course, I would be remiss if I did not mention Risto's efforts on his own podcast, Playing with Research in Health and PE, which has become one of the most popular educational podcasts for health and physical education, not only in the United States, but around the world. Congratulations, Risto. You continue to raise the bar for the profession.
Yes, thank you.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Of course. So this segues nicely to our topic today, Dr. Ramsey. What do you think?
Yes, I agree. Perfect timing. And we're honored to have both of our guests today.
Absolutely. So when we first discussed this episode, Doc, you had envisioned the need to discuss the importance and relevance with research and its meaning. Tell us more.
I agree totally, because we had a past podcast in which we invited undergraduate and graduate students to discuss the importance of applying research to practice. And it's something that is near and dear to my heart, in the sense that I've always referenced. In fact, just yesterday, I met with current teachers and future professionals to discuss the importance of aligning research to practice and how beneficial it is to improving their craft. So I said, you know what? Why don't we just bring on people who do this work and do it well? And let's hear from them, because it's someone that some people that we know that doing this work very effectively. And I just want to make the case for emphasizing the importance of applying the research to practice.
Exactly. Connections at all levels, K-12 all the way up. Right. And you hit the nail on the head with, again, Steve and Risto here today. I mean, couldn't be better guests to discuss this topic. So with that said, Steve and Risto, our topic for today's discussion is connecting research to practice from either a K-12 or Pete and Heat perspective. So we have some questions for you to consider. Doc, yes. Take it away.
Absolutely. Yes. So, gentlemen, both of you, you have done a great deal of research with an impressive publication record. I mean, there's nowhere I go into looking at attitudes or practice of some sort and Silliman names pops up. You're going talking about after school program, risk the name pops up. So what suggestions do you have for our Heat and Pete faculty moving forward with research that may provide more meaning for practitioners in the trenches? Any of you can get us started. That's fine.
Go ahead, Steve. You got a longer vita than I do, so you get, well, you get first crack at these.
Yeah, it's because I'm old enough to be your father.
Technically, one, yes.
I looked at this a couple different ways in that I think we want people to develop a line of research that they're excited about, because no one sustains research year in, year out, decade after decade, if they're not interested. And the issue becomes what is helpful to teachers and what is not doing it. We all can't do stuff that's helpful for everyone doing it. I often think, when I was at at the University of Illinois, with the University of Texas, had two people who had won the Nobel Prize who identified how cholesterol caused cardiac issues. And someone asked them, when did you realize this had implications for health? And they said, yeah, about 15 years into it. You know, they were doing theoretical mechanistic studies before they started seeing that. And so we all can't do those kinds of things. I think if you look at the work, we're all interested, it can be helpful to teachers. The issue becomes, however, that people don't want to read research papers particularly. And so we need to find a way to translate the research. And I often think educators need like an agricultural model where some faculty members produce research and other people are talking about what that means for practice. Kathy Ennis and I tried to do that with the two editions of our book, Student Learning and Physical Education. When came time for a third one, we didn't sell enough to get a third edition. And so we need to find people who translate that.
Yeah, and I agree. I mean, I think that having that line of research is super, super important. But if you want to have this being meaningful for teachers and practitioners in the trenches, as you're asking, that also has to be meaningful for them, right? So like, your line of research can't be top down from an educator or teacher educator going into the schools and implementing your research study. And I'm very guilty of that in my first few studies and even in my dissertation, that I was like, okay, this is what I want to do. This is what I want to find out. This is what I'm going to do. And yes, there's feedback and a little bit of student voice, but it wasn't structured in the way that I think the best form of research could be. If you talk about educational research, which is going to schools and saying, how can we help you? What do you need to know? That also means you might have to be willing to walk away and give somebody else that access because you don't know what you're doing. They talk about, you know, I want to work on social emotional learning and that's what we need. That's not my line of research. So I would suggest them to talk to somebody else. So I think that that's the next step. It's much harder to do because you have to put a lot more work in than just sending out a survey or going into a specific school and asking for access to students. And maybe there's a perk for the school, but you know, and I think the other meaningful part for practitioners is, you know, Steve alluded to this, is the dissemination. Teachers don't want to read research papers that are super dense. So just because you publish the paper and get your name in a journal and you have, you know, whatever impact factor and it fills up a couple lines on your vita, that shouldn't be where that stops. It should be disseminated however you are reaching to the people who are actually, you know, why you do the research to begin with. We as teacher educators, we do research that helps students and teachers, but how often are they reading the research? So it's behind a paywall. It's behind an area where they can't access it. So kind of defeats the purpose in that, in certain ways.
Yeah, I'm
sorry, Victor.
Go ahead, Steve.
If I could just follow up on that, one of the things Risto said is about walking away, and sometimes it's top down. Young scholars have to keep their jobs. And part of that is developing a line of research. So we all can't be all things to all people. And part of developing a line of research is the efficiency of one study building on the next. So you're not starting from scratch each time. And it's not really possible to bounce around without starting over again, which is not good for a person's career. It's not good for the research.
That's a good point indeed. So it's almost, there's a balance there that we have to consider. I agree. Well said. I think Risto kind of segues into our next question a little bit, and with some of his you know, suggestions about talking, you know, about readership of journals and messaging and meaning. You know, how can we increase the readership from a K through 12 perspective? And I think you've already kind of touched on that a little bit, Risto. But Steve or Risto, what do you think can be done to potentially get practitioners more interested in the research from a dissemination standpoint?
I think, you know, Tim Fletcher is a great example of this. He's up at Brock University in Canada. Every one of his articles that comes out of that meaningful physical education lab that they have is written into a blog and then disseminated that way. So, and I think this is part of, and I think they have their full open access papers there, the preprints. And I think this is something to do also with the way the Canadian government provides certain grants, that they have to be open access. So they have it through this website. So you can go in and read that content and the preprint before it gets published. But they also do it in blog format, in shorter forms. And the issue with this is it takes a lot of time, right, of doing that. And I know, you know, we've tried to do that in putting the HPE website as a place where you can publish blogs. And I've tried to keep up with that, and it's a lot of work. I thought I was going to put out a weekly blog, and I'm happy if it's once a month. But I think, you know, ResearchGate, having those full articles up on ResearchGate for people to view the preprints, which are almost exactly what the content is there. And I think things that you two are doing here of having podcasts, of having it in an audio format, disseminating the research that way.
I think if I can add a little bit more to that, I totally agree with everything Risto just said. But we also need to not emphasize people reading whole journal articles. Ideally, teachers would know how to use the library, how to find journal articles, and then read it for what they need. You know, oh, they tried this. Look, it appears kids get more practice trials, more appropriate practice trials when they do that. I should probably try that. And ignore all the other stuff doing it. I often think, even for us, I bet, research papers are not leisure reading. You know, they're certainly not bedtime reading. And so why make it harder than it is? Teachers should be able to look at what they need and ignore the rest. There's no reason to have to pay attention to the rest of it. And, you know, if it says this group did better than that, that tells them the message. They don't have to understand the exact statistic, and there's no reason they should.
Yeah.
Just be able to read it so they can help themselves.
That's excellent, Steve and Risto as well. That's fantastic. I agree. You know, from Risto's standpoint, smaller excerpts of information to make it easier to understand. Risto used the term dense. Tim Fletcher, I know Doc Ash Casey is doing similar things in the UK, and I think certainly kudos to him as well. So that's fantastic. And I think back to Steve's point too, that, hey, let's find, you know, take a look at the discussion, take a look at the results, you know, synthesize that information. And maybe then if someone becomes really encouraged or interested, then maybe then they go back and read other parts to learn more. Well, how did they do that? That's a really great suggestion, Steve. I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. I was thinking, as you were talking about using the parts of it, and earlier when you answered Steve and Risto, about specific things that our teachers in New York City, for example, were asking about how to motivate their students. And, you know, of course, student attitude comes into play, a little bit of classroom management, a little bit about extension beyond the classroom, beyond the physical education classroom. So now hearing this last suggestion, this suggestion you're making about small snippets and areas where people can highlight, well, here are some of the steps that you can take to address the need that you have, whether it's motivating students or whether it's to extend the physical activity of students beyond the classroom or after school or before school. So I like those suggestions again, and I concur with you, Clancy, on that.
Excellent. Well, so this goes well into the next question, and that might be, okay, given what you've just kind of proposed, gentlemen, what are ways that we can better entice HPE practitioners to take a more active role in partnering with research or research itself?
For me, it depends on what you mean by research. I think that practitioners don't have the time to do publishable research, nor should they. It's not part of their job doing it. But action research can help. All right, I have this problem. I've read this stuff. Let me see if it really works here. And paying attention to those kinds of things. And the idea, you know, all of us have doctoral degrees and we're trained to do research. And, you know, it's not that easy sometimes to do it and to collect the data. And as I'm getting toward the end of my career, you know, there are times where it's frustrating and it's hard. And thinking back to those moments, getting a sample size that's big enough, following the rules for analysis. But if people have a problem, read about it, and then design their own little study, action research study, that can help them a lot more than something larger than that, I think.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with the action research piece. I think, you know, we do that in our master's program, that we have only practicing PE teachers in the master's program. In my class that I teach this semester, they're going through an action research project. And we We read action research papers. They've had a research reading seminar that, you know, puts a lot of research in front of their faces. But when we go in, I tell them to have a qualitative and quantitative instrument. But when they're pulling that instrument, it might be from, we use the Veal and Anderson analysis of teaching book. I say, you can use one of those, or you can use a rubric. Now, could you use a rubric and publish a paper in a peer-reviewed journal and use that as a validated instrument just by creating your own rubric? Probably not. I mean, it's here or there, but like I talked to them about, yes, if you were to publish this, then we need to look at all validated and reliable instruments in order for you to do this. Is that something that I'm going to push you to do? Do you have to ask all of these questions? Maybe not. I'm going to still suggest that you do it, but there's also a time constraint. Like they're not doing this for a living. Like they're doing this as a part of their teaching experience and part of their master's program. So I think that action research is the first step to go into if people are looking at starting to do some research and to start small. It doesn't have to be some, you know, year-long immersive study. It can be small problems that you're trying to find answers for.
So I also would extend that a little bit, what Risto said, that I often think professors think everyone should want to grow up to be like us in doing research. And that's not true. Teachers really don't need to do that. I have a brother who was principal of a very large high school in Philadelphia in a PhD program at the University of Penn. And he just decided that the fact that they were trying to turn him into a researcher was ignoring the skill set he had. And, you know, when he had enough credits to get the last possible raise he could, and he had two kids in college, he didn't finish his degree because he didn't want to turn out that way. Good move as far as I'm concerned. And so we need to think that not everyone needs to be like us, you know, and in fact, it would be weird if everyone you know, was working on Saturday nights and doing things that normal people don't do.
Good point indeed, Steve. And, yes. and I'm glad that you wanted to raise the distinction between what we mean by research. And I think, you know, what I was referring to is, I think what you, both you and Risto have said or explained eloquently, the how to get involved, how to partner with, you know, HEAT or PEAT faculty and initial steps, like Risto mentioned, with the action research. So well said, agree, and I couldn't agree more. Baby yes. steps indeed.
Yes. So let me have a follow-up question on that. So can you share with our listeners the importance of applying findings of research to practice? And why is that important? Why should they pay attention to that? To applying research to practice, to make it whether tangible or meaningful, productive. Why is it important to apply findings?
Mr. Do you want to start or do you want me to start?
I'll give a short answer. I feel like if we don't apply what we learn, what people have spent decades in finding out and uncovering, then we're just going to continue doing the same thing that we were doing in the 1980s, 90s, 2000s. Like there's so much information out there. And a lot of our grad students that come in that haven't read research, they're like, oh, I never knew that they had research on motivation or attitude. And they start diving into that to that research material. And they're like, oh, this makes a lot of sense. I should do these different. Oh, I didn't know about this curriculum model. Maybe I could try implementing it. And that could help my students learn better. And it's like all of this information is there and nothing's proven, like this is exactly what works. But, you know, if we don't take advantage of that, it's just, we're just repeating the cycle. It's just we're going to go around in circles in education.
Yes. And if I were talking to a teacher, I'd say, why start from scratch? You know, there's this information that can help you save time and, dealing with issues, and it may not apply exactly, but you know, it can be adapted to what's going on there. So it seems reasonable to me if you can spend a couple hours in reading as opposed to a year of frustration, that's a good trade-off.
Yeah, Steve, one of your current doctoral students that you are supporting, share that with the future professionals we met with last night and said that it is important, it behooves you to look at information that is applicable to what you're dealing with or doing now. And you have to make this a consistent practice. And that's something that you both shared. And I appreciate you both reemphasizing that for our listeners out there that have student teachers or Pete and Heath.
And if I could say, one of the things absolutely that could help this for teachers is the way in master's programs we teach research methods.
That's awesome. You know,
in a lot of places we still teach it the way I took research methods at Washington State in 1976. And, you know, it doesn't help people consume research, read research, retrieve research to do it. And there is research on research methods that suggests if you orient it towards someone being a consumer as opposed to turning into a researcher, they professionals that value it much more than if they if the people are pretending they're going to be researchers. Hey, here's how to read an article. Here's how, this is what this means. I even think when we teach that so that they can read it, we want to talk about what are things that can be taught conceptually. You know, things like trustworthiness and credibility in qualitative papers or statistics in quantitative papers. No one needs to know the intricate details. They need to know, if I read this, what does it mean? And so we can help teachers get to where where they're using that more.
Yeah. And Steve, so... when I was Steve's student at Teachers College, I had a research reading seminar right at the very beginning of my doctoral work there. And he said that the point of the class, like when you are learning research, the point is that you can comfortably talk about research at a cocktail party. And you can like have this conversation with somebody in a casual manner that you can handle the understanding. You don't have to necessarily be able to cite that specific person or that year or know the standard deviation of some article, but you have to be able to handle that conversation. And that's how I introduce our research reading seminar in the same way. You have to have this understanding of it and being able to have a conversation with somebody. And Steve's also the first person that's told me that not every master's student has to do or should do a thesis. And I don't know if you want to elaborate on that, because I was always advised that if you want to go to a doctoral program, you have to do a thesis and then publish it. And that's going to be your kind of stepping stone through. But everybody seemed like they were like, oh, you have to do this thesis or this elaborate project to really understand research. But I mean, research methods was second semester in master's program, like your head's spinning. And then all of a sudden you're like, hey, chapters one through three are due at the end of the semester. And you're like, oh my God. Like,
and we're teaching people the wrong thing. We're teaching them to do it in those few weeks, as opposed a longer kind of thing. Doing it. I would contend for people in education that teaching experience probably would be better for them than writing a thesis for most people. And, you know, most theses are done quickly without the requisite knowledge. We might be teaching the wrong thing when people rush through. And I did a master's thesis in exercise physiology at Washington State. I have not thought about that topic once since I defended my thesis in April of 1978.
Oh, my and goodness.
In the next 20 years I have, I don't think I'm going to think about it again ever.
Wow.
Wow. That's like perfect. I like that strategy that Arista spoke about. And thank you, Steve, for reminding us of Arista, rather reminding us about Steve's class and reading research and understanding.
And I'm all for cocktail parties.
Right. That's true. Some of you alluded to some of those strategies that you already use to motivate your students. I want to start with Risto because you said a couple of them. What other strategies have you used to motivate your students to future professionals to read research and what you i.e. engage them with saying, hey, you know, here's why you should do it. What do you do?
Vic, there's a reason I started a podcast. Because I did some anonymous surveys of my classes and I asked them to be honest, I would not know who they are. So I said, when I assign you a reading and it's a research article, do you read the whole thing, take notes? Do you skim through it? Do you not read it? And I had a lot of students in undergraduate that just don't read the articles that I assign, right? I have students in the master's program that are torn in seven different ways. They got two kids in school. They're trying to do a master's degree. I give them three articles to read that week and they skim through it at best. And there are others that really dive in and read everything. So one of the reasons, like, I don't know how to motivate students to read, to be honest. Like, I can ask them, I can tell them, I can ask them to make a commitment to read it. I can peer pressure them to say like, hey, you're going to be in small groups. And if you haven't read the article, you're not going to be helping anybody push forward the class. So I need you to read. But, you know, and I haven't done a good job at staying with my mission of doing 20, 25 minute podcasts on our podcast. So, you know, they're in 45, 50 hour long podcasts now. So, but I don't know, Vic, I'm here for all the answers. So if anybody else knows how to do that, I just think, and again, let me clarify. I've only worked at state institutions where most of my students have other jobs. My partner went through undergrad at Columbia, and we talk about our difference in our undergrad experiences. And she says, like, she has these deep intellectual conversations about, you know, going to extra seminars, and she has all these small groups and all this stuff. And for me, I was just like, I was just rushing through school to get a degree. I wanted to make sure that I got A's in all my classes, but my mind was elsewhere and I was working part-time. So I think that this is different if you went to a place where somebody was paying you to go to school. I think you're going to read all those articles and you're going to pay attention if you're motivated for it. But I think the students that I teach and the student that I was, they're torn so many different ways. And I didn't really understand it until my time at Teachers College. And I read all the articles, Steve, I promise.
And that self-motivation, and that's the reality that you share with us. And Clancy, when we talk with students the same way, they were talking about their families and other responsibilities. And clearly those are nuances that are familiar with that. Steve, you want to add anything?
Yeah, I think we have to give people the skills to find what they need. And, you know, I always, in my research methods class, spend a night on how to use the library. And everyone starts by, oh, I know how to use the library. Why is he doing this? Well, the fact is they know how to use one library. They don't know how to use another library. And one like Columbia, that is very well resourced. And I think when I came here, because I'm an emeritus faculty member at TC, I can still use the Columbia Library. It took me 6 months until I discovered our library online. And the first 2 hours, my mind was saying things like, how do I do what I did before? And because it's all of the state university system now, we have quite a good collection doing things, but it's It's different. It takes time to learn that. And then how do you do searches? How do you find the things that you're interested in? And how do you read what you really need to read? And I think if people learn that skill, those skills, it makes it easier for them to, when they're motivated, hey, I have this issue in class. I wonder what the research literature says about it, when it benefits them instead of an assignment or something. And of course, now anyone can get on the library at any time, pretty much.
Yeah. And Steve won't plug his own book, but he has a book that I use for my class, which is Reading and Understanding Research. And like we go through in our class, I go through the 12-step model for quantitative, qualitative, and review papers. And for those of you listening that haven't used that book, it's basically you just like break down the article to find the most key important facts. And we go through that. I make sure that they, you know, we have a library orientation. We have all of that. You know, I talk about Boolean operators, which is something Steve taught me. Crazy. And then, so like we go through the 12 steps and I say, okay, after today, you no longer need to use this. You can. And I used it in my first few classes for most of the articles because I needed to take all that information out. But after that, I got my own system and I kind of like now I don't do the 12-step way to read and understand the research, but those are really important for them. Like if you're doing a huge literature review, you don't have to read every single line of that paper once you understand how to look for the right stuff. That's a free plug for that book, by the way,
Steve. Oh, thank you. Absolutely.
We'll accept an ARA happy hour.
I owe you at least two drinks for that.
Absolutely. Thank you. So that was great. Thank you. Thank you for those suggestions there for our listeners. Clancy?
Yeah. You know, it's nice to see, I guess, from a tapered perspective, the fact that, you know, Risto and I have chatted about, we've had students on the podcast for some collaborative sessions, and we've come out of those sessions saying, okay, you know, some have read and some have not, and you can tell. And I can tell that in Steve's case and Risto's case, you're doing what you can to provide lots of different articles and research to potentially explore. And I can see that we're all kind of at that same point at times where, you know, there are certain students that are dive right in and there are certain students that clearly do not. And I think that's almost, we could have a whole nother podcast episode just about ways to motivate them to take a look at that information. I know I go out of my way as a PEAT faculty member to provide articles on content that relates to the topics in our pedagogical courses, you know, whether from assessment all the way through to methods at the elementary or secondary level, whatever it might be. And now with the bevy of research and literature in all those areas, there's so many wonderful resources that, you know, I'm sensitive to when it comes to costs. And so you can use the library and the journals and the literature as a resource instead of potentially texts. I mean, those are things that we're doing to help our students, but it'd be nice to continue to think about ways to make sure that they read the information, synergize synthesize and apply it for themselves from a learning context.
Risto, I got to commend you, man, because you said something that was quite humbling when you said you put out that survey to your students and asked them to be honest with you, brutally honest with you about what it is that they read. They read some of it, if not. I think that's humbling because oftentimes, you know, as instructors, PEAT faculty, HEAT faculty is always don't have the answer for everything. And the answer may come from students. And if you ask questions, like I know in my courses at York, there is a start, stop, continue thing that I've learned with AQ to do, you know, what do we need to start to make this class more engaging? What do we need to stop? That's not working and I'm not gaining anything out of this. And what do we mean, what we need to continue? So I appreciate that piece that you share there. You want to add anything to that? It seemed like you.
No, I mean, I think the mid-semester evaluations are really, really important, because the traditional way of getting feedback from your students, you get the feedback once they're no longer your students. You know, you get the feedback over summer or winter break, and you're like, oh, it would have been nice of me to know that. And I think for even as an early career faculty, when I'm really concerned about student evaluations, you know, I did that, and I was taught the start, stop, continue. And then now I've added to that, you know, reading habits, like how do you read the research? And I asked them about the podcast to see if I'm off base, like, is this helpful? Like, do you enjoy having that option? So, but yeah, I think, you know, there's a ton of good resources. I think, like when I teach TPSR, I use ACPER, which is the Australian Health and Physical Education, basically the equivalent of SHAPE America in Australia. Mm-hmm. They put out these tips of the week infographics, and they have a 2-page PDF of the main points of TPSR, and it's really condensed, colorful, all the information is there. So I approach it with that instead of having them read a 10-page chapter or whatever it is. Now, I'll provide that chapter as a supplemental reading if students want to dive deeper, but I think that there's so many people doing good work that there's so many free resources out there. You just have to dig a little bit. But I think, especially if you have a doctorate degree and you're going back to teach at the university level, you teach the way that you've been taught. And the most recent teaching that you've gotten at the university level is master's and doctoral level. You're reading research articles, and then you're going in to discuss it. But that's not how you engage an 18-year-old or a 19-year-old undergraduate who, you know, I mean, some of them are interested in it, but I think that there needs to be some different types of engagement.
Thank you for sharing that. Thank you.
Well said. So gentlemen, what, and Vic, anything you might want to add to, what type of takeaways can we take from today's discussion? Anything that
can I just follow up on?
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
So I think things like review articles can be helpful to people. Jopard articles can be helpful.
Yes, practitioner based, absolutely.
I think, and you know, I published a lot. I've been cited a lot, but I've gotten more emails about a Jopard article that was based on my Lion Scholar talk about my research. And, you know, I bet every, from teachers, I bet every other thing put together doesn't add up to that. And, you know, we have to think about how we present things and how we write for different audiences when we're doing that.
Sure, reflecting, yeah.
Well said. I mean, and you brought up Jopard and other practitioner-based journals. I mean, talk about meaning and relevance, right? That's exactly it. I'm also reminded, again, Risto, you may recall, props to Dr. Ash Casey for highlighting the work of Carla Leguetti and, you know, some of her research and how she's often commented in her recent work about getting out of the way as a researcher and allowing the study, the research to take its own meaning, to take its own shape and become something that's meaningful for everyone involved. Something to think about.
And I would agree with that. I think there's different types of research, obviously, and Carla does a very participant-centered research, but I think sometimes we, and this is controversial because I say this out loud to people and people push back on this, but sometimes we need to get out of our own way of how we write. And, you know, I think that research should be written so it's accessible to not, and I know that, you know, people, I feel bad saying this, but I really do feel strongly about this, about writing in a way that's really understandable. And the counter argument is that, you know, it's highly theoretical stuff. It's really complicated, but I feel like you're just writing to a certain group of audience that is in academia. But when we really put, like, what is your research for? It's for teachers and students. That's what it's for. So if that population never reads your research, I feel like we're missing a huge, like, logical piece of the puzzle.
Right. And good writing is never bad. You know, if you can make other people read it. And I always think that if you can get someone who's reasonably intelligent to read a draft of a manuscript, and if they have to stop to reread something, it's your fault. It's not their fault. So probably for the first 30 or so years, my wife proofread everything I did. She has a master's degree in business administration, but she knows more about research on teaching in PE than most people with a doctorate as a result of that. But she is able to say to me, this didn't make sense to me. And going through, I've done the same thing for her. And that's really helped my writing, because she can understand it. And so I've gotten rid of some of the technical stuff to make it easier to read. And I think we all have a responsibility to try to do that. Bad writing is never good.
And imagine living in a house when your partner is a professional editor and charges by the word. Like, it's tough. I only put like my tenure letter and like very important emails. I'm like, could you proofread this? I use colleagues to read over the other stuff.
Sure.
Does she charge you?
No, but I don't want to overburden her because she does a good work in her job. So
absolutely, yes. Well, that's an amazing
quote you just used there, Steve. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Good writing is never bad.
Yes, exactly. And on top of that, Risto's suggestion that not only do we, when we think about research, do we want to get out of the way of the research and allow it to become meaningful, but also when it comes time to expressing what's been derived and the findings, get out of the way of the writing. But let's not take ourselves too seriously. I love that. That's fantastic, Risto. Some excellent points. What do you think, Dr. Ramsey? These are some great takeaways. Anything else from
Steve? My takeaway is to pay attention, close attention to what you read and just reflect. That's my takeaway. Reflect.
Right.
It's a really nice takeaway for me.
Absolutely. Risto, Steve, any other takeaways you might have for our listeners in terms of today's discussion?
I would just say that, you know, my takeaway is start small. If you're a practitioner, start small, do an action research project, do a small action research project. And I think in New York, as I recall, you have to get a master's degree at some point for your licensure. So
that's correct.
Get that master's degree, make sure that master's degree is something that you're interested in and vet that place. So you're not going in and getting a master's degree in something totally different just because you want to jump through the hoop and get it. Take a year or two or three before you get into it. Obviously do it before you have to get it, but find a program that fits.
Great advice.
And I agree with what Risto said. This is the start of a conversation and thinking about the topic.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks. So on behalf of New York State AFERD, we'd like to thank both Dr. Silverman and Martin for joining us today to share their thoughts and perspectives. The session will be posted on the New York State AFERD website and on our podcast channel. Stay tuned for new and exciting episodes scheduled to be released later in the year.
Please visit us at newyorkstateafert.org, social media handles at New York State AFERD, or call us at 315-823-1015 for more information. Please also take note that there are many professional development events throughout the year, including our annual state conference upcoming, starting next week, actually, at Turning Stone in Verona, New York, and of course, each year in November.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks.